Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today, we're speaking with Kara Robertson, author of The Trial of Lizzie Borden. Let's hear what she has to say about the Lizzie Borden case. Hi, Kara. We're so excited to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So can you start off by giving us a little background on who Lizzie Borden was and what her upbringing was like? What role did she play in the Fall River, Massachusetts community?
Lizzie Borden was a pretty typical woman of her time. There were many women who were unmarried, 32-year-old, 30-something-year-olds, living at home with their parents, engaged in good works. Which was pretty much the only socially appropriate kind of employment for a woman of her class. She's somebody who I think you'd say checks all the boxes of upper middle class femininity in her era. As I said, engaged in good works, active in her church in particular, a Sunday school teacher of Chinese immigrants, someone who just seemed, you know, sort of like an exemplary, normal figure.
So what was her relationship like with her family, with her father, her stepmother, and her sister?
On the surface, it would have looked fairly typical. But beneath the surface calm, the Borden household was the site of a Cold War. They lived together in a converted tenement house. So in other words, it had been for two families, and it was converted into a one-family home. And that's significant only in that it meant that there really weren't any halls. So if we think of the things that make space more private for people when they're living together, when they're adults living together, for example, the idea that you wouldn't have to walk through someone's room to get to another room might be something that gave you a sense of more privacy. And in the Borden household, the daughters of the house, Lizzie, who was 32 at the time of the murders, and her older sister, Emma, who was 41, conducted their lives as separately as possible from the elder Bordens, Andrew and Abby, who was the stepmother of the daughters. They essentially lived on different sides of the house and met downstairs in the middle on those occasions that their lives overlapped.
So Let's jump into the crime scene. And could you walk us through what that was like? What did police find when they entered the home of the Borden family on that day?
On the morning of August 4th, the prosperous mill town of Fall River, Massachusetts, was the site of a grisly double murder. Andrew Borden, who was a very prominent and prosperous local businessman, had been hacked to death on his sitting room sofa, about 10 blows probably. And it later transpired that his wife had been killed earlier, and Abby Borden was found face down in an upstairs guest room, and in her case, subject to an even more vicious murder, that she received about 19 blows. So those who were on the scene were just horrified by the brutality of the crimes. It just seemed so out of character for an otherwise fairly quiet area near the center of town. And the assumption was that it must have been the work of some sort of madman. And that was the initial principle that the police went on in terms of looking for the killer. The problem with that theory was simply that there were two women who were in the house at the time of the murders who didn't hear anything and who survived unscathed. The Borden's younger daughter, Lizzie, and the housemaid, Bridget Sullivan. And so it seemed, one, difficult to imagine how a crazy person from outside with some sort of violent designs on the Bordens would have managed to get in the house and hide himself for an hour and a half between the murders. And it also seemed unlikely that such a person would have avoided either of the two women who were known to be at home at the time.
So who were, right off the bat, some of the initial suspects? Was Lizzie one of them?
Lizzie was a suspect fairly early on, but a little bit reluctantly. I mean, the first thing the police did was essentially round up the usual suspects. They assumed that this was going to be, that there was going to be some insane immigrant in the area, and that seemed most likely. So there are many police reports of following up suspicious activity on the part of recently arrived Irish or Portuguese immigrants. But when attention turned to the people in the house, there were three possible suspects, because there were three people besides Andrew and Abby Borden who woke up in the house that morning. And those were John Morse, Andrew Borden's brother-in-law from his first marriage, Lizzie Borden, and Bridget Sullivan, the housekeeper. So the police naturally looked at John Morse first because he was the man. And also his visit just suspiciously coincided with the murders, that he was the one who arrived the night before. And so he seemed to be the loose thread in the household. But he turned out to have an alibi that was worthy of an Agatha Christie novel. And he was riding on a streetcar at the time with supposedly, a dozen priests. And although the streetcar conductor couldn't remember him, the conductor did remember the priests. So that seemed to rule him out. So that left the two women. And the police, of course, looked at Bridget Sullivan, because Irish immigrants were viewed with some suspicion. And although this seemed like the sort of crime that would have been committed by a man, because it was a hacking, bloody, awful murder that seemed to require strength, that was something that seemed more consistent with an Irish maid, basically, than a nice upper middle class lady who's, you know, involved in her church. But Lizzie Borden's account of events seemed to exonerate Bridget Sullivan, the maid. And it was also true that she was spotted outside washing windows at the time that the first murder took place, that of Abby Borden. So she seemed to be in the clear. So that really left only Lizzie Borden. And when the police investigated her, they saw that this you know, that all was not pleasant in the Borden household, that there was a fair amount of ill will, and that Lizzie Borden herself seemed to be at the center of that.
What, right after the murder, what was the media's take on the case?
The first hot take was horror that a murder like that would have been committed in this town. It was the third largest city in Massachusetts and the most important textile producer, but it wasn't the sort of place where violent crime was rife. And so the idea that an elderly couple were killed in their home, you know, near the city center, and no one saw or heard anything, just seemed utterly shocking. And when it became clear that Lizzie Borden, the daughter of Mr. Borden and the stepdaughter of the other victim, Abby Borden, then the responses split, so that the Irish Catholic community and other immigrant communities that were served by their own papers wondered why the police were taking so long to arrest the obvious suspect when they would not have been so delicate had the suspected person been, say, a mill hand. And by contrast, the papers that served the Protestant elite of the city, the people who owned the mills and were allied with them, they were horrified that someone like Lizzie Borden was even suspected. You know, the idea that was even thought possible was, you know, a bit of an affront to the social order.
And how did Lizzie Borden then respond to her arrest? Who did she enlist to help her in her defense?
She had a local lawyer who very quickly saw that he needed some assistance. And so he hired a very prominent Boston area trial attorney. And then ultimately the former governor of Massachusetts, who was a folksy character, who was known to be very good with juries and had been very popular in the state.
So the actual governor of Massachusetts was part of her defense?
The former governor. Not the current governor, but he was someone who appointed one of the judges. So
interesting.
something that you wouldn't have seen today. I think that the thing that occurs to people looking at it, you know, in this sort of historical era, I think you'd say the closest thing to this was the O.J. Simpson trial, where you get this extraordinarily high-powered talent to help the defendant fight the charges, then also to help the defendant construct an image that's going to be most sympathetic. And there are earnest, very capable prosecutors who are a little bit clueless of the cultural white noise that surrounds the case.
And what was it at the time? What was that white noise?
Well, the fundamental issue was really, could a woman commit a crime like this? I mean, not just any woman, as I said, that it wouldn't have been so shocking had the housekeeper been accused, an Irish immigrant. I mean, it would have still been viewed as terrible, and it would have been hard to take. But the idea that someone who seemed pretty average and was going about her life in the respectable and approved manner, that she would sort of suddenly pick up a hatchet and kill her father and her stepmother just seemed so beyond the realm of possibility that it was hard for anybody to take in. Now, had it been poison, that might have been a little bit easier to, if you'll excuse me, stomach, because poison was considered to be a feminine weapon. But part of the difficulty of this crime from the prosecution standpoint is that this is an exceptionally brutal set of murders. And that's something that just seems completely inconsistent with the sort of defendant who's on trial.
Can you speak to us about the actual court proceedings? What angle did the prosecution take, and why did they contest Lizzie Borden had committed the murders?
The prosecution had a straightforward theory, namely that Lizzie Borden had exclusive opportunity as well as motive to commit the crimes, namely that she gave an inconsistent and sort of unbelievable account of how she spent her morning. Sometimes she was upstairs, sometimes she was downstairs. She was ironing handkerchiefs, but the job remained undone. Then she went into the barn to and ate, looked for a sinker and ate some pears. Just a lot of sort of aimless activity. And the idea was that really no one else could have gotten into the house and hidden himself, thus avoiding both her and the maid. And if that was the case, then the only question is, you know, did she have some kind of reason, you know, in her own mind or motive for doing it? So Lizzie Borden had exclusive opportunity. She was the only person who technically could have committed the murders. And for motive, the police turned to this Cold War that existed in the household and theorized that Lizzie Borden had been wanting to kill her stepmother so that her father, perhaps, actually this was never proven, but I mean, perhaps because she feared her father was going to make a will that was going to disfavor his own daughters in favor of his wife, or for some other reason, but you know, stemming from hard feelings over a property dispute that had happened about 5 years ago. And the idea then was that she always meant to kill her stepmother, and her father just sort of wandered in at the wrong time. And so she was forced to kill him as well. This, as you can imagine, is the weakest part of the prosecution's argument, because they just never can quite bring themselves to formulate a theory for why Lizzie Borden would kill her father. Everyone seemed to understand why she might want to kill her stepmother.
Wow.
Who, I should just say parenthetically, you know, is probably the most sympathetic person in this entire story. She's actually not at all like the stepmother of fairy tale. She seems to have been really a well-meaning, slightly self-effacing woman who unfortunately was in the middle of some very hard personalities.
Yeah, some real family drama that she just kind of walked into.
That's right. That's right.
So what is the legal, Lizzie's legal team's defense in the case?
Well, they attack the case from a number of angles. I mean, they point out that it's not their job to solve the mystery. You know, in other words, that they don't need a coherent explanation for who else could have done it. So from the perspective of combating this idea of exclusive opportunity and motive, the defense points to other odd characters seen in the neighborhood. This man who's referred to as Dr. Handy's wild-eyed man, because Dr. Handy, a local doctor, is the one who first spots him. And then there's another man also spotted by a woman who seems to be lurking outside the Borden residence. And the idea is that simply because you didn't see anyone else go in doesn't mean it wasn't possible for somebody else to go in. And, you know, one would hate to convict somebody who was really just in the right place at the wrong time. You know, it's clear she's supposed to be in her home of a morning. That's where she's supposed to be, attending to the household tasks. And that's a point that the defense hammers home because it makes her seem very ordinary. They take issue with the idea that a stranger couldn't have gotten in. And then as to motive, they make this a case of tension between adult stepdaughters and their stepmother. You know, what could be more ordinary than that? You know, women are like that. They have these disputes, but it doesn't actually mean anything. There are lots of stepmothers and stepdaughters who aren't close friends, but that doesn't mean that, you know, murder is imminent.
So then who is part of the jury and what verdict do they eventually come to?
The jury is all male. There are actually no women seated on juries in Massachusetts until 1951.
Wow.
They're also all white, although it was technically possible for African Americans to serve. And there had been a couple of cases of that. Of that service in this era. The other thing that's notable is that there's only one Irish Catholic on the jury, and that seemed to have been a deliberate strategy on the part of the defense, that there was a sort of suspicion that they might view their client with the hostility that the Irish Catholic paper did. And the Irish Catholic paper used to refer to her as the Sphinx of Coolness because she was too self-controlled, you know, and that sense of self-control for an unsympathetic viewer spoke to some sort of masculine nerve, and that made it somehow more likely that she would be a murderess. I mean, I should say that the same behavioral qualities were viewed by sympathetic observers as signs of, you know, inborn bearing and ladylike American grit. So it was very much a question of what lens you were looking through as to how you interpreted her behavior. The biggest point in Lizzie Borden's favor was the brutality of the crimes. And although medical experts testified that a woman was perfectly capable of causing that kind of damage, that all that was required was sufficient leverage in the hatchet or the axe or whatever the implement was, it was never conclusively proven. The defense just simply kept saying, contrary to the medical evidence, that women just weren't capable of that kind of brutality. And that seemed to get a sympathetic hearing in the jury room.
And it said that they came up with the verdict in something like 10 minutes.
That's right. They were unanimous on the first ballot, and they just stayed in the jury room for a while so that they appeared reasonably deliberative and out of respect for the prosecutor. This is a case, I would say, not of reasonable doubt, but rather of a unreasonable certainty that someone like Lizzie Borden couldn't have done it.
So what was Lizzie's life like after the trial?
Well, Mr. Borden was known to be a bit of a miser. And although he was very wealthy by Fall River standards, they lived in a fairly modest home, this converted tenement house in which everyone had her own bedroom, but it was by no means grand. And it was in the Flats, which is the central business district, which was convenient for his work. But it was said that Lizzie and Emma always wanted to live in the Hill District, which is in a, you know, social, both a geographically elevated and a socially elevated area of town. And so shortly after she went home in triumph, she and Emma moved to what you might call a McMansion in the highest part of the Hill District. And she continued to attend church, but she was quite quickly shown that she wasn't welcome there. The pews near her were empty, and she was essentially frozen out by the church that had provided the bedrock of her support when she was on trial. And I think the idea was that she was supposed to live down her notoriety, and that the elite of the town, as represented by the churchgoers and the other people who might have, say, lived in the Hill District, were quite prepared to back her. I mean, she was one of their own. But that's quite different than wanting to, you know, have her to tea afterwards.
Wow.
So you could say she was sort of shunned, that the ostracism was the punishment. On the other hand, it's also the case that it doesn't seem to have fazed Lizzie Borden at all. She enjoyed having some money. You know, as I said, she moved to a fancier house. She had a car and driver. She had a special seat built into the back of the car so that her dogs could ride around with her. She went to the theater in Boston, you know, and she generally sort of, you know, lived it up. I've always thought that the strangest part of the story, or maybe the most telling part of the story, is that with her inheritance, she could have gone anywhere and chosen to live out her life, you know, if not in anonymity, at least not as a constant figure of, you know, local notoriety. And she chose to stay in Fall River. And I think that says something about, you know, her personality, about her nerve, and also perhaps about her parochialism, you know, that in a sense, the extent of her ambition was to live in this better district of Fall River. And she sort of couldn't imagine a life beyond that.
Why do you think that over 100 years after these murders, and why are we still fascinated by them?
I think for some of the same reasons that the people were at the time. I mean, it really is just shocking to think of a seemingly normal person who's not giving a lot of signs of massive instability or violence. The idea that such a person, I mean, particularly a woman, would suddenly pick up a hatchet and kill her father and stepmother, and then just go about afterwards and have a kind of normal life too. I mean, I think it's the combination of the brutality of the murders and the discreetly veiled and gloved lady who sits in the courtroom accused of them. It also, you know, it's almost a mythic story if you strip out the historical specificity of it. You know, it's the story of these almost archetypal figures trapped in a house together, and the tension building and building and building, and all sorts of grievances coming to the surface. And then finally, it's a bit of a locked room mystery. You know, there are only a few people, if you rule out the murderous stranger, who could have committed the crimes. And it's very much dependent on people being at certain places and certain times, and could somebody have hidden, or could somebody have gotten back across town? And so I've often thought of it as a sort of locked room mystery written by Sophocles.
It's interesting to think of the, you know, author of this, you know, story. So at the end of the day, you know, we always ask our guest experts this question. If you had to pick one person or thing, it could be a concept, that you think is to blame for the murders that happen in the Borden household, who or what would that be? Do you think that Lizzie Borden was wrongfully accused, or did she commit the crime?
Well, you know, I am a lawyer as well as a writer, so it's difficult for me to commit in that respect. What I'd say is that, you know, I'm in sort of the same place as many of the journalists who covered it. When they first arrived, anyway, they became Lizzie partisans later. But it's hard to imagine how anyone else could have done it, right? And eluded the women who were in the house at the time. But bigger picture, I'd say patriarchy is in that it is absurd that, you know, people who just didn't get on had to live with each other, when in fact one imagines, assuming Lizzie Borden did it, that you know, they could have had a quite nice life in a separate.
They sure had the money for it.
Right. It's just, you know, if it were within the realm of possibility, you know, you just think they had a couple of you know, they had some spare money. I mean, surely Emma and Lizzie could have moved away and everyone could have had their natural life and just visited at Thanksgiving and Christmas. But sadly, that was not to be.
Well, thank you so much, Cara, for joining us and helping us, you know, understand this very interesting case that has, you know, we've been obsessed with for over 100 years.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. I look forward to hearing what you make of it.
I think you'll be pleased.
May I add one thing?
Yes, please.
There's sort of two things that I left out.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they're of any use, you know. So the first is that Lizzie Borden was thought to have tried to purchase prussic acid the day before the murders. And that was an extremely important piece of evidence for the prosecution because it showed intent, you know, punctured the idea that she was just this innocent bystander in the house, that she was somebody who had murder on her mind. And also because it is a feminine weapon, unlike the hatchet. And so the fact that she couldn't get the prussic acid might go a long way towards explaining why she would have picked up this, you know, male weapon, this hatchet, a household implement, if there was some urgency to dispatching her father and her stepmother. And then the second thing I just left out is that Lizzie Borden burned a dress on the weekend after the murders. And there are many people who believe that had blood spatter on it. She, by contrast, said that, you know, it had just been old and paint stained and produced the seamstress as well as the painter to agree that it in fact had been old and paint stained, and that might offer an explanation, an innocent explanation for why she might have chosen to burn it.
Interesting. Okay. So these are two very important key pieces of evidence that we will have.
Yeah. Right. The poison doesn't get in at the trial, which is important, you know, so it limits what the prosecution can argue.
Oh,
you know, I didn't know how deep in the weeds you wanted.
Well, we did discuss it. So definitely, I think that'll be really interesting for our listeners. And it is a part of it. So,
right, right. And yeah. And the other piece of it is that Lizzie Borden never agreed that she tried to buy it. So the defense would have argued that the identification was false in some way. And then as a backup, they were prepared to argue, and we can see this from the preliminary arguments they made to exclude the evidence, that there are lots of innocent uses for deadly poisons in households in that era. There are lots of cleaning products that contain benzene and other things that are very dangerous, volatile gases. And that Lizzie Borden, supposedly, or whoever it is that asked for the poison, said that she wanted it to clean a sealskin cape. And there's some absurdity to that in that it's August in Fall River and it's very hot. And no one had ever heard of such a use for prussic acid. But the defense very skillfully keeps the prosecution witnesses from being qualified as experts in that particular area. Like they might be experts in furs, but they're not experts in poisons. Or they're experts in poisons, but they're not experts in furs. This is where the defense, I think, really shines. And so that, too, just gets kept from the jury.
Wow. I mean, just so skillful, especially for the time. Thank you so much, Cara, for, you know, diving in, giving us the whole scoop.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With us today, we have producer Clayton Early.
Hello, everyone.
And fact checker Chris Smith.
Hello.
So how about that? I felt like we were circling in on the patriarchy. Hello. We ended up sending Lizzie Borden, of course, to the alarmist jail. But patriarchy was,
there was lots of crossover, and it feels good to have a lawyer validate us. Can I just start with that?
100%. It makes you feel like
we're basically lawyers.
Makes you feel like we could be lawyers.
right.
Yeah.
I'm married to a lawyer, so you are a lawyer.
Yeah.
I basically am a lawyer. Yeah.
I mean, if you say something and then a lawyer says pretty much the same thing, technically, who's the lawyer?
I think we all are, right?
That's what
I think
I'm
saying. You are, Chris. That sounds like a lawyer would say something like that.
But can we please talk about what Cara was saying about the living situation? Because that was another thing. I felt like we were we were spot on.
Really
we were pretty spot on.
You talking about the floor plan and her just saying the lack of hallways, like that little tidbit it's a very fascinating thing to consider when you're talking about people trapped in like a confined space together.
But the way she put it, lack of hallways, I had never thought about that concept and how important hallways are.
Think about all the things that happen in hallways. You make out in hallways. Your lockers are in there. I'm thinking mostly of hallways in high schools. Is that what you guys are
thinking? Yeah, imagine going to your next class and not being able to walk in a hallway to get to your next class. You just are walking through other people's classrooms.
What a mess.
How disruptive that would be.
No, but I mean, seriously, though, the sense of privacy that a hallway allows for.
Mm-hmm. I will never take a hallway for granted ever again.
We should expand all hallways, make them bigger and better.
Agreed.
So we can have less murdering children mad at their parents.
But these roommate tensions, I mean, the fact that that Lizzie just kind of lived on one side of the house and tried not to, involve herself with her parents. I mean, I can't imagine the tension that must have been brewing in that household. Like, it just feels like one of those families and houses that are so uncomfortable to walk into. Yeah. And just like, you just don't want to be there. I can't imagine that tension.
I feel like the nature of, the way that Cara described her, she's like this proper, like high society lady who is very prevalent in her church work. Like, you can imagine the type of like quiet, like reserve call it repressed if you want, like the you're so angry at your family or your living situation, but you're like a good Christian woman, so there's like only so much that you can express about that.
And that was used in her defense and against her, as Cara right. pointed out. They called her, I guess the Catholic newspapers called her Sphinx of Coolness.
Yes.
Which right? would be a great title for her first album if Lizzie ever wanted to be a rock
when she
artist.
Partners but up with Fleetwood Mac.
She could have been an amazing jazz musician, and that could have been an amazing first album. But
I see her in more of a new metal, like a heavy metal genre.
Sure.
Yeah.
But regardless, thinking about it in terms of how you could look at that, and the prosecution said something to the effect of, well, she's so cool. Like what's bubbling underneath? And in her defense, it's like, no, she's just like, that's evidence against her being able to commit these crimes. She had it all mm-hmm. together. She was
right.
Cara say that she's sort of gritty American, good American woman.
Mm.
She called her, she was involved in good works. That was the term.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, she does good works. It's all of that just seems so classist to me. This
totally.
Idea that Cara was saying that they couldn't wrap their mind around the fact that like a woman of this nature could just not possibly commit this crime, but the Irish immigrant housekeeper, she could.
Right.
Because she's just like a poor immigrant and she has the strength and grit to do it, but not these proper ladies.
So much classism.
Makes you think of the distinctions we make today of people and the way they look and the way they and what kind of class they come from and mm-hmm. what we expect of mm-hmm. people from those classes. It's why we love relearning history,
like,
because this type of thing just repeats over and over again, and some people never learn, but we do, and so does the alarmy.
Speaking of repeating history, I thought it was really interesting when she just pointed out, you know, the difference between the two newspapers and how a lot like the Irish Catholic newspaper was very frustrated with why the police weren't arresting her the way that they would someone in their own community. And I was like, wow, that sounds very familiar.
Jeez, why are we still living like the late 1800s? You'd think.
I don't know.
The big bomb that Cara dropped after, I don't know if we're going to include this. I think if we should, is the poison that Lizzie tried to purchase beforehand.
Yeah.
And the fact that wasn't allowed in the trial. I feel like that's huge.
Right.
Right.
Because it totally shows intent. And it could have bridged that gap in certain jurors' minds about, is a woman capable of this crime? And it's like, whoa, the female crime is poisoning. So the female way of murdering someone is
that's
poisoning.
That's a female crime.
So, and she tried. Geez. She tried.
And there she tried. She couldn't. So she...
So this is what ended up happening.
Right.
Okay. Well, I'm so glad we got a chance to speak to Cara and kind of, you know, get her expert take on this fascinating case. Now, I feel like the verdict stands, right?
I think so.
Because...
So just to remind everybody, we put...
Lizzie is in jail.
Lizzie in jail, and the patriarchy got the big slap.
Well, we called it female oppression.
Right.
Right.
To be technical, right. But I mean, come on, we can...
Right, we went back and forth on that. But yes, patriarchy. Let's keep it as is. And Lizzie, she did get away with it in real life.
Right.
But... Looks like,
but not in your world,
not in the alarmist world. So yeah, Clayton, is there anything that we kind of have to any housekeeping, major housekeeping? How are we doing on reviews? Because I feel like our numbers have not gone up. I don't think we've gotten a new review lately.
You know, we got one that I feel like I really want to share.
Okay,
because it's a great review, but it seems it's a little suspect.
Mm-hmm.
It's titled, Chris is My Favorite.
What? Wait a second.
Five stars.
Can you say that again, what the title is?
Yeah, Chris is My Favorite. This was October 7th of 2021.
Chris.
Okay.
I'm the only
by Chris. By XO Akim. And it says, I signed up for Apple Premium Plus and I love it. It's 3:21 a.m. And I'm writing this review because I care so much. I don't want to go to Alarmy Jail for making the pod go away. The podcast has been a staple of my long walks and bike rides, so thank you. I love history and Chris. I'm glad you're all around, especially Chris, and that's a fact.
Wow. Very wow. Suspect.
I mean, and that's a great, lovely review, but Chris, you are on record on this podcast as saying you have started your own profiles.
Fair enough. I have a dicey history of creating false accounts, but I promise this was not me. And I know the thing I'm supposed to say at this point is I'm very humbled, but honestly, it actually is the opposite. I feel very proud and opposite of humbled. I feel sort of filled with myself.
It's right curious now. That they even said the time that they wrote the review. I don't know, Chris.
Right.
What were you doing late at night on the 7th of October?
Well, I don't know. What was Lizzie Borden doing?
We should have a trial for this comment.
I was just in my room.
Then we'll decide. Well, a live pod. We'll do it on the podcast. We'll do a live trial and get all the evidence.
Exactly. We'll get a guest expert from Apple Premium Plus to...
Cara's a lawyer. She could represent us or, I don't know, Chris. We'll figure it out.
We'll decide. okay. Well, thank you.
Keep them coming. Yes.
Yeah,
keep
them
coming.
Thank you, Chris or whoever that was for the review. And again, you know, we really appreciate these reviews. They help us get visibility on the show, and it's really important. So we're very grateful. And if you haven't done one yet, please. It takes about, I don't know, how long did it take you to write that one, Chris?
Hey,
nice.
Knock it off.
Nice.
It takes, I don't know, 30 seconds. Thank you to the Alarmy. Thank you to Cara Robertson. And thank you to my loyal producer, Clayton Early. And of course, our fact checker, Chris Smith. And shout out to Alex Paul, our coordinator and researcher. Stay tuned, because we are going to be discussing
the Halloween poison candy hysteria.
Thank you, Clayton. This is why we love you.
Earios.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There's stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like worried of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.